Finance will come to order. The Finance will come to order in order for us to hear, take testimony on Senate Bill 4001. Joined today by Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, Senator Co-Chair Wilken, and myself, Senator Green. Shortly we'll be here will be Senators Olson and Hoffman. And we have quite a lot of information to go through today. Senator Wilken, could I get you to move the CS, please?
Madam Chair, move the committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 4001 Finance Version G, dated 11-15-06, as our working document.
Is there any objection? Objection. Senate CS for Senate Bill 4001 would be adopted as our working document. I would like to have Commissioner Nordstrand come forward and give us a kind of a history of why we're here today and what brought us to this point so that we can key in on the actual focus of this hearing.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Scott Nordstrand. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. And I think a good place to start for us today might be to go to Section 9 of the packet that was provided to you by the Governor's office. That is the timeline. And I thought it might be appropriate to just give some background to the committee and the public on how we got here today. And we could, Senator, if we don't have your packet, we could make copies.
That might be good. Rose will be about making copies.
There we go.
Oh, that's right. That's the bound notebook. Okay.
Just wait for Senator Olson.
Many of us have it, just didn't happen to bring it, so. Brief of these while we get the copies ready. Meeting will come back to order. We now have the material reference in that Section 9 on the ACLU case timeline.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
As everyone is aware, the Alaska Civil Liberties Union sued the state of Alaska and the municipality of Anchorage in 1999 to require the state municipality and effectively all political subdivisions of the state of Alaska to provide same-sex partner benefits through their health plans and through the state PERS-TERS retirement plans. The complaint was filed, as I said, in 1999. In 2001, the Superior Court, Judge Stephanie Jonides, concluded that the state had not violated the equal protection provisions of the Constitution and in denying these benefits. However, some years later, in October of 2005, about 3 weeks after I took this job, we were provided with a decision from the Supreme Court that concluded that the Superior Court was wrong, that, in fact, not providing these benefits violated the equal protection provisions of the Alaska Constitution. And let me just explain how the thinking goes here, because I think it's important in understanding what the remedies are that are available. As you well know, in 1998, the Alaska passed a constitutional amendment providing a marriage amendment, essentially saying that marriage is between a man and a woman. And what the Supreme Court concluded in their decision was is that because a heterosexual couple in a committed, intimate relationship could go downtown to the courthouse and get married, they were able to obtain benefits in a way that same-sex partners in a similarly situated, committed, intimate relationship could not do because it was constitutionally barred. As a result, essentially, of the marriage amendment to the Constitution, the court concluded that same-sex partners were being discriminated against unconstitutionally. And they, interesting for the lawyers, they reached this based upon minimal scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause, which, frankly, is fairly unusual for a court to conclude that, based upon minimal scrutiny, the choices made by the government in terms of how they spend their money is unconstitutional. So that's what happened in October 2005. The other curious thing, I guess, about what happened was that the Supreme Court retained jurisdiction over the case in October, saying that they wanted to hear briefing on what the proper remedy was. And this is important to understand that the Supreme Court didn't say what to do because they found this discrimination in October of 2005. They just said it was discriminatory, and now it was left to decide what needed to be done to resolve that. And so in January of 2006, the ACLU and the other parties to this litigation submitted briefing to the Supreme Court suggesting the alternative of how to resolve this. Now, in the case of the state of Alaska, as I understand it, the Department of Law outlined a process of presenting this issue to the legislature, that legislation would need to be crafted to determine who would be eligible for these benefits. We set out a timeline that we thought was appropriate at the time of springtime legislature consideration, regulations to follow, implementation to follow thereafter, open enrollment for those that are qualified, and ultimately providing benefits on January 1, 2007, which is a date that will become important as we go through this timeline. So that was the state's plan. And it's not, I think, any different than what is the norm throughout the country. You've heard about other states where these kinds of issues have arisen. The Supreme Court says it's discrimination not to provide benefits or not to provide for domestic partner relationships, and they give the legislature some period of time to craft a solution to the problem. That was our solution. Unfortunately, the Alaska Supreme Court did not tell us what they thought the remedy was going should be until June 1 of 2006, after the regular session of the legislature had ended. So then we were left with, and you can see, and I think you should take a look at the Supreme Court order. Let's see, is it the very last one? Let me look. Yeah, it's section 10. It's right after this. Should be. This is the order that was issued on June 1, the 1.5-page order. It provides that appellees, that's us, shall provide no later than January 1, 2007, benefits complying with this court's opinion. Now, what that means is we not only have to have a system up and running, we have to actually be providing benefits by January 1. And then you'll see the language on Section 3 of their order that describes the provision of authority to the Superior Court to issue whatever orders are necessary to make sure this happens. And that's part of the process that I'll describe in a minute that we've been going through. So that was issued on June 1. The state was left with the choice of how is it we're going to do this. And with the legislature not scheduled to meet again until after the effective date when we're required to provide these benefits, the state's initial idea was essentially to draft regulations through the Commissioner of Administration, as I am the plan administrator for retirement and benefits, which includes the active and retiree health plans and the retirement plans. And so we went about that process. There's a timeline in here that shows, you know, how we've gone through that. In September of this year, I published draft regulations to provide these benefits. They're largely the same as the ultimate regulation that was approved and finalized. We went through a process of public hearings and public comment in September for 30 days. And then in October, we finally issued a final regulation that is part of the record here. And that was on October 13. The retirement portion of those regulations would have become effective on November 12th. But for an emergency regulation that I filed last week, The active plan portion of these benefits is sort of in limbo because of the Lieutenant Governor's refusal to endorse and file them, which is part of the Administrative Procedures Act. I will say, and so that gets us close to where we are today, but I want to say just a little bit about the process that we've been through. In terms of the court's involvement in our administrative process, it's been quite unusual, I would say. Throughout the process, we have been issued order upon order requiring that the Commissioner of Administration essentially turn in his homework to the court for checking before the regulation is even effective, before the regulation is even final. And we have had a series of court hearings and pleadings where we've essentially debated draft regulations in front of the Superior Court. I have been uncomfortable with this process because just as the legislature has a role in the primary role in drafting the laws of the state of Alaska, so too the executive branch has a delegated role of essentially drafting legislation in the form of administrative regulations. And I can tell you that I've had 2-hour hearings in the Superior Court where even before our regulations are final, we're being challenged to justify, for example, we can talk about the criteria in our bill if you'd like, but why do you have 5 criteria out of 8? Why not 3? What's your constitutional reason for doing that? Why do you have exclusive committed intimate relationship, not just committed intimate? And I have, just as a matter of protecting our deliberative process and the executive branch authority in this area, we've essentially refused to provide the court with the Department of Administration's reasoning for why we've made these choices, particularly since the regulation wasn't even final. We were asked, and I found this fairly extraordinary, we went through the administrative hearing process where we listened to public comments. We took 15 days to integrate those comments into final regulations and then provide them and then publish them. We were ordered by the court during that period of time that before we actually went to final regulations, we should provide those regulations to the court some 8 or 9 days before the deadline so that presumably our work could be checked before it went to final, and that was in fact the process that took place. And we were told ahead of time that if we issued the regulations that we planned to, that they would be deemed unconstitutional. So that's where we got to. Now, fast forward to why we're here today and how we got here. After our final regulations were issued, and after the court then concluded in an order that you have, and you can see it at tab 11, the court basically concluded that the regulations that we promulgated are unconstitutionally strict. And the court went so far as to specifically change elements of the regulation. Exclusive was taken out, and you can see that in terms of the nature of the relationship. The duration of the relationship that we had set at 12 months was changed from 12 to 6. The number of financial criteria that were required was changed from 5 to 3, and then another criteria of joint custody of children was added that would trump all the other financial criteria so that only that criteria was necessary and no other financial criteria was necessary to meet the test. Other benefits were added that were not in our regulation related to leave, family medical leave type issues, and to a presumption of who should receive the final paycheck and leave for a deceased state employee. We did not include those. They were not part of the original suit. They were simply added after the fact. That was all added, and this left us, and frankly, if you read the last part of that order, which was October 30th, therefore the state is ordered to immediately incorporate this court's order into its regulations or otherwise modify its regulations so they comply with the Supreme Court's mandate. or in this case, the Superior Court's mandate or interpretation of the Supreme Court's mandate. This was an order as a result of a request for an emergency regulation, and as you well know, an emergency regulation is effective upon adoption. And as you also know, retirement benefits, at least the retiree side of this problem, those benefits cannot be diminished constitutionally once given. So I was faced with the possibility that we were one Superior Court order away from creating a new retirement tier of benefits. And that retirement tier would have applied to all current state employees and all current PERS TERS employees who would one day retire. And in the face of that, I often talk this sort of being between a rock and a hard place. That's the rock. The hard place was that our regulations themselves were being called into question by the lieutenant governor and claiming, and it is a legitimate argument, that does the commissioner of administration really have the authority to, by regulation, amend statutes? And if you look, essentially what the court is asking is you can look at AS 3935.535, which is the PERS benefits section. It basically says who gets benefits under their retiree health plans. And you can look at the active plan under 3930090. I'll use an example here. It says, each eligible employee of the state, the spouse, and the unmarried children, chiefly dependent on the eligible employee for support, they get the benefit. So you guys have written this into the statute. That's what the law is. And what I've been asked to do is to insert same-sex partner along with a definition. Now, the lieutenant governor believes that that is usurping the authority of the legislature to write the laws. The Department of Law and others believe that if the Supreme Court issues an order, and you saw the order, that says go do it, that you have sort of super authority to go do it as necessary to comply with the Constitution. It's an open question in my mind. In any case, that's the hard place. And so that's when I asked the governor to consider bringing you all back to Juneau to consider how best to implement this decision. And I'm sort of the end of the story.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, or Commissioner, how in American law has there ever been a provision whereby what we used to call, when you and I were kids, common law marriages got to the status where a common law marriage qualified somebody for benefits?
I honestly don't know, Senator. I do know, I've been told that common law marriage isn't recognized in Alaska. But I don't know. I would suppose that if common law marriage were recognized in some other jurisdiction and therefore they became legally a spouse, that perhaps that would have been recognized for benefits, but that's conjecture.
Okay. Yeah, you can see where I was going. I was wondering if indeed that had happened, then whatever criteria a jurisdiction had set up mm-hmm. for recognizing a common law relationship mm-hmm. might indeed be a defensible paradigm for what you've been trying to do heroically. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Senator, I would be remiss if I didn't speak a moment about, despite the fact that there is a committee substitute, and I understand that, but the governor's bill here that was provided to the legislature is essentially a codification of the regulation that was the final regulation I issued on October 13. And I should say we tried to find a reasonable place to be here. We took essentially the criteria that the University of Alaska has been using for 10 years to provide these benefits. I think we tightened up the language in some places. We made it more clear what was included, what criteria are necessary. We did, in fact, require that documentation be provided to the state rather than it be available if asked. We had an annual requirement that an affirmation be made that the same conditions were met in terms of the criteria for eligibility. So it was a bit tighter in that sense. But for the most part, we simply adopted what the university has been doing for 10 years, and we thought it was a fairly reasonable set of criteria, and if the committee's interested, we can talk about those criteria, but...
Any other questions of Commissioner Nordstrom? Thank you. You'll be in the room.
I'll be here for questions if they come up.
I've been remiss in not recognizing some people in the room. Representative Mike Kelly, Representative John Cockfield, Senator Gary Stevens, and I know that Senator Hollis French just came in and stepped out. Okay, Representative Coghill, if you could come join us and kind of walk us through the committee substitute, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just to answer one of the questions that Senator Dyson asked, the common law marriage in Alaska is not recognized, and there are several court cases on that.
Excuse me, and if I may, and were those brought up, those court cases, in reference to benefits, qualifying for benefits, some kinds of benefits?
I could not say. I don't know.
Thank you.
This is a statute that I had prepared for work in the House, and you adopted last night. And because of the nature of the events that have transpired through this last year, from the Supreme Court case till now, the rulemaking process that has gone on with the Superior Court, and some of the disagreements, I think, fundamentally on the policy calls, I drafted this statute. There are several laws that it affects, but the notwithstanding any other provision of law covers those. And I suppose we could go through a whole list of those. I'm not prepared to do that at this point, Madam Chair.
Okay.
But I'm sure willing to work on that. This is really a way of saying to the administration, the legislature wants to reserve the right to do the policymaking call on benefits given to employees of same-sex partners, unmarried state employees, that it needs to be a statutory provision. Certainly, the difference between the legislature and the courts have become very clear. In 1996, we actually passed a statute that says a same-sex relationship may not be recognized by the state as being entitled to the benefits of marriage. And effectively, what the court has done is overruled that, saying, whereas they cannot marry now under equal protection, they are the mirror image of marriage, which I don't think was ever really the intention of that particular amendment. So we find ourselves in a situation where there's a disagreement between two co-equal branches of government. And I think the best thing to do to tell the administration at this point is that that disagreement is ongoing, and we will put them on notice that the benefit should be described by statute. So that's the intent. That's why I had it drafted that way. I know there's going to be legal disagreements, but you will find, even within our own legislative legal, they must acquiesce in some way to the court's decision. I think as a policymaking body, we are not necessarily bound to that. I think we need to speak very boldly, and my intention is to do that.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Coghill? Thank you very much. You'll be in the room all week.
I have a meet with some of the leadership of the House. I will be in and out, though.
Thank you very much. In your packet, you will find a 2.5-page memo from Legal Services. Pam, could I get you to come forward, or who you want to have with you to kind of walk us through this so that we're aware from the outset what the comments are from Ledge Legal?
I'm sorry, Senator. I didn't know whether you said Pam or Tam, so I came too. I'm Pam Finley.
We're both here. Both of you, Pam and Tam. Good.
Got the A team.
The AM team.
Very good. And who will be doing the presenting today?
I think I'm going to defer to Pam Finley for most of the questions because she has worked more intimately with this issue than I have.
Okay, thank you, Tam. Okay, Pam, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Pam Finley, and I'm the revisor of statutes. I work for Legislative Legal Services.
You might want to pull that microphone just a little closer.
Is that better?
That's better.
Thank you. Did you have questions, or did you just want us to go over our legal concerns?
I'm going to go over the concerns so that we have them.
The CS before you puts the Commissioner of Administration in an uncomfortable position, to say the least, because he has a court order that says one thing and a statute that makes it a crime to do that. And I just think that ought to be pointed out, that I suppose he can speak for himself, but it is a concern. Mm-hmm. The second one is what the court would do in the face of this statute if it were passed. And I see essentially, assuming that this statute were passed by itself without any other legislation that set up benefits. I think the legislature could certainly say, we're going to do this, and this is what we're going to do. This is how we're setting it out, and we don't want any regs done. But if the legislature does not establish a same-sex partner benefits along with the prohibition of the regulations, if it just prohibits the regulations, then the court has basically, I think, two choices. It has to say, okay, is this statute constitutional? Because does it deny equal protection in the sense that it prevents an implementation of the Equal Protection Clause as interpreted by the court? So it could declare this statute unconstitutional. The other thing it could do...
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I don't need to interrupt, but
no,
thank you. If this statute was explicit that it was only to be enforced for, say, 8 months till the end of the regular session, and it stated that the reason for that was for the legislature mm-hmm. to take up all of the policy issues here, would that ameliorate the situation and maybe give the court some room to allow us that?
It would certainly probably be a much more palatable solution for the court rather than just simply saying we're just going to refuse the regulations and not let anything happen, if at least showed the, I suppose you might say, the legislature's good faith in attempting to try to deal with this next session. In other words, if you simply made this basically a temporary provision for a certain number of months, is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, ma'am.
I think that would probably be somewhat more palatable. I still couldn't guarantee that they would accept it because they did adopt this January 1 deadline, and it's been a year. It's been over a year since they made their decision, the underlying decision, not the remedy decision. So I can't promise you that the court would find that an adequate response to the Equal Protection Clause, but it's probably better than a temporary provision would be better than a permanent one.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Other jurisdictions who have wrestled with this issue have said that just tactically and policy-wise, that it's what they did, and I'm thinking particularly of Texas, was they adopted statutes that allowed for any state or public employee to designate some other person as a dependent, and therefore, with probably additional contributions and so on and so forth, any other person could be included in the beneficiary category, which arguably would allow A out for these other non-traditional relationships. But I worry that doing that doesn't really get to the heart of what the Superior Court has ruled, and that is that it doesn't give functional equivalency for these same-sex domestic partnerships. Would you comment on that?
Through the chair, yes. I think what you would actually be doing if you adopted that approach was you would be taking marriage out of the benefit scenario.
Yep.
That that marriage would not be the issue. And therefore, I would think that equal protection before married and unmarried people would not be the issue either. In other words, I think, what I guess what I'm saying is the bottom line is that that might very well work. Because what you would be saying is, we don't care about marriage. We're not asking about relationships. Just one person. You know, each employee gets one other adult, and that there's a broad equality in that position. It's not just for married. It would cover married couples. Obviously, they could designate their spouse. It would cover same-sex couples. It would cover unmarried people who aren't living with anybody, but perhaps have a dependent mother or aunt. I don't know exactly. Okay. Sorry.
And thank you for the latitude. I had a brilliant question and I've lost it. Thank you.
Good. I wasn't really ready for a brilliant answer. So.
If you continue, please.
I know what it was.
Oh, go ahead.
If we chose that strategy, could we retroactively impose that new criteria of what the beneficiary is on all the existing enrollees, active and retired?
Through the chair, for retirement systems, you couldn't diminish any rights, but to the extent that you are granting additional rights, you can certainly do that retroactively because the state is self-insured, so that you're not really worried about another insurance company.
And it would seem to not be a diminishment, or would it be?
Through the chair, I think that would probably depend on the circumstances. There might be, I haven't thought that through, so yeah. I'm not really sure whether in all cases it would be an addition, but... because there are always the questions of domestic relations orders when there's been a divorce, and I'm not quite sure how it would play out in all circumstances.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, that's a hypothetical I hope we don't have to deal with. go ahead.
You can. Okay, that the first possibility was that the court would declare the regulation invalid. I think the second possibility is that... the court would simply say, well, all right, the legislature hasn't acted, and now the Commissioner of Administration can't act, so we will simply order the state to give these benefits for these people. And my guess is that the court would probably use something fairly close to the regulations. Courts do not like to do this. I think perhaps the best example I can think of is in the old busing cases after Brown versus Board of Education. And the courts would send it back to the legislative branches and the executive branches. And eventually, however, if they felt that the executive and the legislative were not giving what the court viewed as constitutionally required, the court would just order it. One of the disadvantages of that, which the courts realize, is that they don't have all the opportunity to hear all the testimony and see all the possibilities and the things that legislatures do and the administration does when it's making regulations. That factor may not be quite as strong here if the court pretty much took the regulations that have already been developed. Mm-hmm. They might just take them and tweak them as they saw necessary and order the Commissioner of Administration to give these benefits. That's not the preferred way, but it's a possibility.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In light of your last comment about the order from the court to go ahead and have the commissioner go ahead and implement the program, what role does the separation of powers deal with that if for some reason the commissioner decides not to follow the order?
Well, yes, this reminds me of the question about how many legions the Pope has. I forget what that was in regard to, but what you're asking about is enforcement. And the court does not have troopers, no. But you would have to have an executive branch all the way down the line willing to ignore a court order and be held in contempt, and it gets very messy.
No handcuffs, though.
Not to my knowledge, unless it may perhaps, I don't know, maybe the court does have something that I don't know about, but I think they don't have troopers. Thank you.
Any other questions? Do you have any other comments?
I did have one about the, this provision, I think, has a retroactivity provision, and that can create some problems to the extent that rights vest. Commissioner Nordstrand just said that his emergency regulation of November 10th was intended to keep the retirement aspects of these regulations from vesting last Sunday. And when I read that emergency order, I'm just not sure that it does that. What it does is it says that they don't apply until November 22nd and only to the extent they're consistent with something that you all pass. In other words, if you passed something different, then they wouldn't apply. And I just, I'm not absolutely positive that something hasn't already vested. I'm not sure what it is. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should go back and explain. Commissioner Nordstrand has said this several times, but it's kind of a hard thing to wrap your mind around, so I'd just like to express it again. And that is that these regulations have many sources. There's reg making authority from the three retirement systems, and it's very broad. It's quite broad. And under regulations adopted under those retirement systems are not subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. They become effective 30 days after they're adopted. And these original regulations were adopted October 12th, if I remember correctly. So they would have become effective November 12th. I think it was Sunday, sometime before now. And on the other hand, and that's those were the regulations that this emergency regulation was meant to deal with, to attach to keep things from vesting last Sunday or Saturday, whatever. And as I say, it may have done that, but I'm just not positive. Not positive that it has. It certainly had some effect on them, but whether it's a complete prevention of vesting, I'm not sure. The other regulations as to active employees, right, medical benefits, SBS, those sorts of things, those have to go through the Administrative Procedures Act, and they cannot take effect, which means that there's no vesting of any rights until they are filed, and they have not been filed yet. In terms of vesting of rights, you kind of have to look at what you're talking about. There are two tracks here. To the extent that there are vested rights, if there are vested rights, then the retroactivity clause cannot divest those rights. So I don't have any other comments. Thank you.
Any other questions for Pam or Tam? Thank you very much for being here. Did you want to speak, Tam? Did you have anything?
Well, I guess I would make one comment that is prompted by Senator Dyson's remarks about the Texas system. And I think that it's important to understand that if the state were to adopt some sort of a benefit system that excluded married spouses also, then you wouldn't have the equal protection problem. And that's essentially what the Texas system does, is it just eliminates benefits particularly for married spouses. It makes a category that's very broad instead. And obviously there are some ramifications about how it would apply to people that are currently vested. But if the state right now, for example, were for new hires to say we aren't going to provide any benefits to spouses, then you don't have the equal protection problem that the court has identified.
We also have another fascinating circumstance here. We're about to have a changing of the guard, and the court's orders have been to the existing administration. In 3 weeks or so, we're going to have a different one. Would a new administration have some firm ground on which to ask the court to stay the date of implementation here while the new captain of the ship explored options and so on? And how would court look at that? And does the orders given to one administration just automatically or in force against the next one? Is there appeal to that?
Well, it strikes me that the new administration can, of course, ask the court to modify its deadline, but I don't think it can demand that as a matter of right. I can't predict what the court would react, how they would react to such a request.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much for being here today.
Online is Kevin Clarkson, who wanted to address the same issues that Les Legal has just addressed. Kevin, are you online?
I am.
Would you go ahead and begin your introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, ma'am. I'm Kevin Clarkson. I'm an attorney that was retained by the Legislative Council last summer to address this issue in respect to legislation that was being considered. And this morning in particular was asked by Representative Coghill and Senator Dyson to address some of the legal opinions presented by Ledge Legal. And I wanted to start out by pointing out that the committee substitute, as I understand it, is not intended to be a no-benefits bill. It is intended to be a separation of powers bill that basically says the Commissioner of Administration will not adopt these regulations. The legislature will take this issue up. I think Senator Dyson's idea of adding a time limitation to the effectiveness of this bill is a very good idea, because I agree with Ledge Legal to this one extent, and that is that if this bill was intended to be a bill that says there will be no benefits given, period, that would be, according to the Supreme Court's opinion in October 2005, unconstitutional. But if the intention of this bill is simply to delay the effect of the remedy, or the granting of a remedy, or the establishment of a remedy to correct the constitutional problem the court has identified, then that would be a legitimate exercise of the legislature's power as a co-equal branch of government. And I would point out that in the other states where this situation has arisen, notably New Jersey most recently, and in Vermont several years ago, where Vermont is a good example, because you've seen the entire process go through. The Vermont Supreme Court issued an opinion much like the Alaska Supreme Court's opinion. It said there is a constitutional problem because marriage is extended to one group of people but not to another. It needs to be corrected, this constitutional problem. The court there left the remedy open and said the legislature should go pick the remedy, but there needs to be a remedy. And the process that the court allowed for the remedy to be implemented involved close to a year's worth of time, because the legislature wasn't in session at the time the court issued its order. The court waited for the legislature to come into session and address the problem, which the legislature of Vermont did. And Vermont has been operating under a domestic partnership system ever since. If that's the intent of this bill, then there is not, in my opinion, a constitutional problem in that respect. Because I want to point out, as Commissioner Nordstrand emphasized, the June 1, 2006 order from the Alaska Supreme Court didn't direct that regulations would be adopted. It simply directed that benefits would be provided by a date, January 1, 2007. And I want to emphasize that while there is constitutional significance to the court's order interpreting the equal protection provision, there is no constitutional significance to the January 1, 2007 date. There is significance in the sense that the court ordered it, which is not to be trivialized, but there is no constitutional significance to the January 1, 2007 date. So that's my comment. I think it would be a legitimate exercise of the legislature's power to say, we will address this issue. This is a statutory issue that should be addressed by statute. We'll take it up. You would confirm that and certainly assure the court that's your intention by adding a limitation to the time in which this bill would be in effect. And I would suggest you make that the end of the legislative session coming up in 2007, whatever that time period would be. And I guess I agree to most, for the most part, with Ledge Legal about the retroactivity issue, but I disagree in the sense that I do think Commissioner Nordstrand's emergency regulation does delay the vesting of the benefits that would have gone in effect on November 12th otherwise. And so I do not see a retroactivity issue here in that respect. I think the court would respect the legislature's attempt to step in and address this issue statutorily if they see a time limitation on the bill so that it looks like the legislature will in fact take the issue up and not simply put it off indefinitely. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any questions for Kevin? Thank you very much, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your being available to testify this morning. We're going to take a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and continue with our public testimony. We're back on the record, and we'll continue our testimony. But before we begin, Pam Finley has something that she wanted to offer to us.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It's really a follow-up on what I was saying before. There were actually two things. One, it has been brought to my attention, and it's true that as to making a crime retroactive will not work. I just would point that out because of the ex post facto law. You really can't do that, even if you wanted to your commissioner. The second thing, though, it has to do with the question of what might make the court more comfortable with an extension. And I would say in the first instance, I'm not a mind reader. I don't know exactly how they think, and I don't claim that this will work. But if I were in the position of the court, I would be concerned about granting an extension because there's been so much time elapsed. And one way to deal with that is simply to say that the commissioner's power is suspended for this particular period of time, maybe to the end of the session or some shorter period if you figure you could do it by then, but that if the legislature does not act by that time, that any regulations adopted to comply with this case by the Commissioner of Administration thereafter would be retroactive to January 1 of 2007. So, we don't advocate, and I really don't, I'm not trying to advocate that position. It's just that if I were on a court, I think I would be, one of my main concerns would be we're going to have more time slippage, and that you at least could take care of that concern.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I wonder if you could draft up some wording to that effect here that we might be able to use as an amendment.
Yes, through the chair, I could do that if I could have a few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
May I be excused for now? Or
oh, absolutely. Right. Thank you very much, ma'am. Okay, next on our list is on the teleconference is Michael McLeod Ball. Michael McLeod Ball, are you online?
Madam Chair, I'm here.
Thank you very much. If you'd give your testimony, I'd appreciate it, please, if you'd announce who you are.
Yes, Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska, and we're the one of the parties involved in the underlying dispute. I don't have a formal set of comments, but I'll make a few brief comments, and then I'd be happy to take questions from you, Madam Chair, from the members of the committee, if you so wish. I have not seen the version G that you're working on now, although I think I saw it in a different form, if I've heard the testimony correctly, and I'll try and direct my comments in that regard. The opening comments I do have relate to the governor's legislation, and we oppose that legislation because we see the legislation as being unnecessary and because it sets up a different set of standards for qualifying two different groups of individuals for benefits. And therefore, because it sets up two different sets of standards, it's discriminatory, and we believe it would be held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, just as it held the status quo to be unconstitutional about 13 months ago. You know, we appreciate all the work that the administration has done to try to put regulations into place that it believes comports with the Supreme Court's decision. Both sides have been working hard toward that end. I would also say that I think we agree, and it was in our original briefs last January, that the best place to resolve this issue would be in the legislature. I believe the reason that the Supreme Court held off issuing its order until June 1st was because both parties, both the administration and we, had submitted briefs in January that suggested that the legislature ought to have an opportunity to address this issue. I know I personally had conversations with people on both sides of the aisle in both chambers regarding the Supreme Court decision of October 2005. And I know for a fact that the issue was front and center, and nobody chose to submit any legislation on it during the last session. And I think because of that is the reason that the court issued its order in June, setting up the January 1, 2007 deadline. So I would say at the outset here that I pretty much agree with everything that Commissioner Nordstrand said. Their timeline is a good timeline of everything that's happened so far. However, I would make that additional point that I think the Supreme Court's view on this is that it needed to step in and mandate this timeline because it viewed the regular session in 2006 as having produced no result. That being said, we oppose this legislation primarily because we think it's unnecessary. We think the whole reason for the call, of course, as Commissioner Nordstrand said, is because of the issue that was raised by Lieutenant Governor Lehman. I think everybody, not everybody, but I think the general consensus of the attorneys that have looked at the issue is that the issue identified by the Lieutenant Governor really isn't an issue. Credit the Commissioner for trying to use an abundance of caution in adopting regulations, but our attorneys, the administration's attorneys, and I believe even some of your attorneys have suggested that the issue really isn't one to be concerned with and that the Commissioner does, in fact, have the authority to adopt the regulations that have been put forward. The other issue, though, that's presented is whether whether the Governor's proposed bill is constitutional. And Judge Joannides at the Superior Court level has already said that she thinks that they're unconstitutional. We're pretty confident that that would be upheld at the Supreme Court level. And so, therefore, adopting a statute that that ratifies regulations that have already been deemed unconstitutional is likely to itself be unconstitutional, and therefore, that sort of heightens this notion of the passage of the bill in that form as being unnecessary, at least from our perspective. I would like to make just a couple of other points. There have been a number of public statements saying that members of the legislature object to the courts mandating that this resolution be adopted by regulation, that the remedy be adopted by regulation. And I just want to make it clear that there has not been a court order to that effect. Rather, again, as Commissioner Nordstrand had said, there was this order of June 1st where the Supreme Court sent the matter back down to the Anchorage Superior Court to oversee the implementation of the remedy. The first proposal that that the remedy be adopted by regulation came from the administration in its statement to the court of how it would intend to come into compliance. It was the administration that suggested that they had the authority and intended to adopt regulations, and that's what started the ball rolling on this particular process. The court never stepped in and said you have to do this by regulation. The other issue is the one related to how deeply is the court involved in actually writing these regulations. I suppose we're looking at it from two sides of the same coin, but it seems to me that the court has been attempting to provide assistance and guidance to the administration as to what it would perceive a set of regulations as being constitutional or not. And I think the court has been very careful to craft its orders to that effect. As a matter of fact, I believe the judge has said several times that she does not believe that she has the authority to write these regulations. And so the most recent set of regulations conditions that were set out in the court's more recent orders, saying that the commissioner ought to change the regulations that he had promulgated, the additional language that the court included in that order said, look, here are some criteria that I think would be constitutional. Commissioner, come back to me with regulations that comply with this order, and you can choose to adopt my proposed criteria, which I'm telling you right now are constitutional, but also she was very clear to say that you could come back with other alternative criteria, and she would examine those for constitutionality. And so when the commissioner came back with alternative regulations that are now on file at the court, but that have not been adopted, the commissioner adopted the language that Judge Joannides had suggested, but did not offer any alternatives. The judge then came out with another order that said, or another opportunity that was extended to the administration to submit other alternative mechanisms for achieving this constitutional compliance with the Supreme Court's decision. And the administration chose not to submit any other alternatives in that way. So to suggest that the court has actually been attempting to write these regulations, I think is a mischaracterization of what the court's been trying to do. I think the court has been trying not to be involved in the ultimate detail of the regulations, but has rather been trying to comply with her obligation to meet the Supreme Court's mandate to her to make sure that benefits are in place by January 1st. I hope I made clear the distinction that I'm trying to make there. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Are there any questions for Mr. McLeod Ball? Well, Michael, I listened to your statement, and I always enjoy hearing from you, but I still think there's such a fine distinction as to the court's involvement. And it's, as Scott Nordstrand said, it's highly unusual. And in your history in observing and as an observer, have you seen at any other time where the court has been quite that interactive in the regulation preparation process?
I believe it was Ms. Finley that came up with some examples. I know there have certainly been other situations. The interesting discussion here is about the roles and the powers of the three different branches of government. I think nobody questions the fact that the courts are the ultimate arbiter of what is constitutional and what is not constitutional. I think everybody agrees that the executive branch carries out the day-to-day operations of the government, the legislature sets the policy. But figuring out exactly where the dividing line is the struggle here. Judge Joannides, in her very difficult task, I think has really struggled with trying to find that right line, and that's why I think she has been so particular about some of the language that's been in her order to try and give the administration the opportunity to come up with alternatives. That being said, I think she views it as her obligation to let the parties know what she believes is constitutional and what is not, with the understanding, of course, that ultimately that would go up to the Supreme Court for the final decision on that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, Mike, I too appreciate both your involvement here and the spirit you bring to this. And in that regard, I want to ask you a question that will seem a bit bizarre, but I'm not wanting to sensationalize or demagogue this issue at all, But I understand some jurisdictions have said that gender is not limited to biology or the plumbing diagram, but indeed what gender the person considers themselves to be, and that some jurisdictions have been dealing with the fact that persons with gender ambiguity who have chosen not to have an operation have been recognized as being of the gender that's different than what their biology is, and that has produced some very interesting legal questions and so on. Do you have any knowledge about what's going on in other parts of the country, other jurisdictions in that regard?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I read a newspaper article within the past week or two. I think it was out of New York, but I don't really have any personal knowledge of that. And I don't think that those issues are really germane to this particular discussion. You know, we've got a unique set of facts and circumstances here in Alaska arising out of the Alaska Constitution. And, of course, any constitutional decision in any other state doesn't really affect how our Constitution operates. Our Supreme Court interprets the scope of the Equal Protection Clause of the Alaska Constitution, and that may be the same, or it may be narrower, or it may be broader than other states. We do know, for example, from decisions here, that the Equal Protection Clause in the Alaska Constitution is deemed to be broader than the Equal Protection Clause in the federal Constitution. And so I think, you know, while it may be sort of interesting to talk about these issues that have come up in other states, I don't really think it's germane to a discussion of whether the employment benefit system in Alaska is discriminatory under the Alaska Constitution Equal Protection Clause.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I'm just wondering if we're liable here, if we go forward with the court's jurisdiction, we're liable to have a unmarried heterosexual couple claim that they could get same-sex benefits by one of the participants claiming that they are, in fact, of the gender that's different than their biology. And I realize that'd be a rare situation, but I'm just wondering if that might be a runner end around what we're doing here for a few folks.
Senator, I don't think so. As I think Commissioner Nordstrand explained in his comments, the issue here for the Alaska Supreme Court was that the state had offered the justification for its existing benefit system that it was trying to encourage marriage, and that the only group that was barred from marriage were those of the couples who were same-sex couples. And so, therefore, I think if you have any opposite-sex couple, there's nothing in the law that would bar them from getting married, and therefore the stated justification for the benefit system, in other words, to encourage marriage, is not at play in restricting them from benefit.
Yeah, thank you. I believe you didn't answer my question, but thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Michael. We appreciate your being on today, and again, appreciate your manner and the way you present yourself. So thank you very much. We
thank
also
you,
have
Chair.
Online several other people, as well as some people here in the room, so we're going to have to kind of keep our comments as brief as possible so that we can be sure that we have everyone taken care of in the time frame we've allotted. Dave Bronson?
Yes. This is Dave Bronson from Anchorage.
Okay. Your introduction and who you represent, just yourself? Or?
Well, I just represent myself at this time, so I just was notified of this meeting this morning through someone at the Alaska Family Council, and I appreciate that. Okay. I'd also like to say thanks to the senators for going down there for this special meeting, especially under these adverse weather conditions. I really appreciate you tackling this problem. Today, I'd like to say I'm a man on the street kind of guy. I'm not a lawyer, and I'll leave the legalities to the lawyers. I'd just like to kind of look at it from the perspective of the right and wrong in all this. And from my perspective here, the Supreme Court certainly seems to be doing an end run around the expressed will of the people. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 25, is real clear on what the people of Alaska have voted on and what they think. And they're also, I think, they're doing an end run around the constitutional authority of the executive and legislative branches of government. I hope you can see that. The timing of this issue, the way they have it was constructed by Administrator Nordstrand, is that this has been timed perfectly so you people cannot deal with it. And at this time, you need to stand up to this and look at this for what it is. And to differ with, I think it was Mr. Clarkson before, I agree with a lot of what he says. And of course, a lot of it was legalese, and I'll leave that again to the lawyers. But the idea of giving benefits to everyone, basically any adult that demonstrates or designates a partner, it certainly seems to me to be two steps forward after the court has ordered us to take three steps back on this. The people have spoken on this, and this is really clear. Why do the people need to be hindered? I mean, especially a financial constraints, or I should say attack on the PERS-TERS system. This is going to create, according to Administrator Nordstrand, a huge liability of the PERS-TERS system as exists in the system is already suffering. I just think this is a time to stand up to this at this special legislation, stand up to the court and say no on this. And there was a remedy here last spring that, of course, because of the gas line issue and everything else, that the legislature couldn't deal with it, and that was SGR 20 and HGR 32. Those pieces of legislation right there would put this issue to rest by amending Article 1, Section 25, and it takes this out of the hands of the court. I hope you... At this point in time, the Senate and legislature has an opportunity. You can either, you know, thumb the nose of the people who have already spoken, or you can thumb the nose of the Supreme Court. And this special session is very important, and you need to deal with this now. This is important. This is a very important issue. And again. You can deal with the people or you can deal with the court, and this is the time to just say no to this court. If you're not interested in this issue, what is the court going to do next time? Maybe your issue is I don't know, gun control or game management, something like that, and they're going to do this again because they've done this in the past, and now is the time to limit their authority, and especially on this issue. So, again, that's all I have to say. I'll let the lawyers work out the details, but that's just a man-on-the-street perspective on all this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling in, Dave. And Jim Minnery? Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. This is Jim Minnery with the Alaska Family Council. I'll make it brief. We're certainly hearing from a lot of individuals across the state about their concern about the usurpation of power by the Alaska Supreme Court, and I think that ultimately the people of Alaska do deserve to have the final say on what type of relationships are publicly privileged and subsidized. I think it's important to know that a year and a half ago there was a resolution that was put forward in the Colorado legislature to provide benefits across the board, as has been mentioned, to anybody within the state of Colorado that was an employee that could identify one beneficiary. And what happened was that was voted down and opposed by the same group that was trying to get same-sex benefits. And essentially what that, I think, showed was that ultimately this is really not about benefits, but it's about public affirmation of a particular type of relationship and at the cost of denying those same benefits to folks that are not in a same-sex relationship. I think that the Supreme Court has overstepped its authority that the definition of marriage in our Constitution, the majority of the 152,000 people, we believe as an organization, probably thought that that already was taken care of in the amendment to the Constitution. And this is an attempt to create a counterfeit of marriage that is against the will of the people. I also think that a critical public policy decision shouldn't be decided in a hurried special session by an outgoing legislature and administration. The timing of it seems to be particularly of concern to a lot of people, and we think that it's a matter of sufficient importance to allow the incoming governor, her administration, and the new legislature to review and make a determination on. And thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling in, Jim. It's always good to hear from you. Just as a matter of clarification, I received this earlier and I forgot to mention it. In the comment about the retroactivity clause referring to the violation of the crime in this subsection, actually the language in the bill only refers to subsection A and not to subsection B, which is the crime. That section is not retroactive, so that is not in play. Dan Wayne, you're for questions only?
That's correct. I'm here for questions only.
Thank you. If we have any others, we'll get back with you. And for Lee Badgett from UCLA Law School.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you, Senator. I'm here.
Okay. Well, we do have your very nice, I think, 7-page document that you have sent us, and we appreciate that. If you could give us the high points of that, we'd appreciate it.
I would be happy to do that, although actually I was going to make two even briefer points, which related to the regulations that have been proposed and adopted by the Department of Administration. My understanding is that that is the substance of the bill that you're considering.
That's correct.
And I just have two very simple points that I want to make related to those regulations. The first is that the criteria that have been proposed and adopted are quite stringent. I've been studying domestic partner benefits as an economist for well over a decade now, and the criteria themselves fall on the far end of the stringency spectrum. These are among the most stringent of any employers that I have seen. Secondly, the level of documentation that's required is almost unprecedented. It's quite rare that that employees are asked to provide this to sign up a domestic partner for benefits. And just to give you a sense of what the criteria mean, they mean that employees may have to incur legal costs and other costs of changing the names that property is held in or that rental agreements are held in. It imposes a burden on probably on many of the people who are likely to want to sign up a partner for benefits. The second point that I wanted to make related to the cost increase estimates that were circulated as part of the proposed regulations and have been, I guess, recirculated as the part of the final regulations. The point that I want to make is, first of all, I've done similar cost estimates. I think you have a version of those in that document that you mentioned. My estimates are based on data from the U.S. Census from 2000, along with the current population survey, which is done by the Bureau of the Census and Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then also the state of Alaska's own records related to its health insurance plans for its employees and retirees. And in putting together those different pieces of information, my estimates are quite a bit lower than the state's. We're not too far off in the first year. For some reason that I can't really imagine, the state's estimates blow up over time and get quite large towards the fiscal year 2010. But my estimates are much lower. In general, I would expect the additional cost to be never more than $1.4 million and probably much less than $1 million per year. And I'll just point out that these are pretty much, my figures are pretty much in the same range as the consultants that the state hired to look at this, Deloitte and another local consulting firm. Their estimates were quite similar, both in terms of enrollment increases and in terms of cost increases. So I think to the extent that you're concerned about what those costs may be, I think you should expect them to be much lower than the Department of Administration has projected. So those are the two points that I wanted to make, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, what would the percentage increase on your calculation be?
I used a couple different possibilities. Deloitte used a half of 1% cost or enrollment increase estimate. A more recent study that I've done that allows us to look very directly at domestic partners and same-sex domestic partners and enrollment and health insurance plans suggests that it would actually probably be lower than that, probably more like 0.1% to 0.3%. But even the 0.5% is a reasonable projection. It still results in very much lower figures than the states.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thanks for helping us out here. This is perhaps a bit of an academic question, but I assume that sometime in the future we'll face the same question that what we've commonly called incestuous relationships that are precluded in law, common law or statute law, will be, folks will come to us and say, wait a minute, we are a couple in a family similarly situated, why should we not have access to these benefits under equal protection? And as you probably know, in Canada, they're already facing the issue where polygamous families are saying, how come my first wife gets benefits and my second and third one don't? And they are very similarly situated. And on what basis will we be able to say, no, those are still precluded? Or will we be able to?
Well, I would have to leave some of the legal details of that question, I think, to the lawyers. I'm an economist. What I can tell you from having studied this is that in the United States and in European countries, and to my knowledge, so far in Canada, there have been no examples where those requests have actually been implemented to the extent that they've occurred. And to my knowledge, it's quite rare. And the one that you mentioned in Canada is the only one that I've heard of that's been reasonably well documented. So I would not expect that to be a situation that you're likely to face upon adopting these regulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Dr. Badgett? Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate that. And
you're
we certainly
welcome.
Appreciate your document that you sent so that we can review. Nancy Homestead?
Yes, I'm here.
You could give your name and who you represent, please.
My name is Nancy Homestead. I represent myself, and I would just like to make a couple of brief comments.
Go right ahead.
First of all, I would like to say that I believe that there are a large number of people in the state who agree with Lieutenant Governor Lorne Lehman that the Supreme Court did not have the authority to adopt or to pass this regulation when we had an amendment that already defined marriage. And I believe that when we voted in 98 to define that marriage relationship, that the intent of benefits was also part of that vote. And if the Supreme Court does not agree with the fact of intent on benefits, then I believe that should go back to the people, and the people of Alaska should have the right to vote on benefits, the intent of benefits for domestic partners. My second comment is I also believe that this is being handled in too much of a hurry. I would encourage the Senate to delay action on implementation, that the timing of this is not good. The consequences are very significant and the expenses are very great. And I also would like to make a comment about the situation, the example in Canada. I believe that if we head down this road now, that situation in Canada is where we're headed in the future, and I do not believe that that's what Mainstream Alaska wanted, and they represented that, and they portrayed that in the vote of 98, defining marriage as one man and one woman, and that's my comment.
Are there any questions for Nancy? Nancy, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your calling in and your information.
You're welcome.
Jan DeYoung, you are online for questions only.
Yes, questions only.
Thank you very much. Steve Jacquier. Stephen, are you still in Anchorage? If we hear back from them, we'll have their testimony. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, some of them may need to push their mute button.
Can you tell if he's still on? You cannot? Okay, thank you. Barbara Belknap, here in Juneau.
Hello? Hello?
Yes. Who is speaking, please?
You're live now. Here, that's the microphone. So when you push that. Yeah. So open. Open my green is go. Yeah. This is Anchorage. Can you hear us?
Yes, we can.
Oh, thank you.
Is Stephen there?
Hello, Madam Chair. Our apologies. There were some technical difficulties. Yes, Stephen Jackie, President of Anchorage.
No, go right ahead. If you would introduce yourself and who you represent, please.
Certainly. My name is Stephen Jacquier. My partner and I have lived and worked in Alaska for a combined total of 44 years as school teachers, University of Alaska professors, and small business owners. We have two children, one in college and one in high school here in Anchorage. Madam Chair, with your permission, may I preface my brief testimony with some quick man-on-the-street observations in reply to a senator's earlier question?
To apply to what?
In reply to a senator's earlier question.
Go right ahead, but be aware that we are kind of under time constraint, and if you can include that in your comments, that'll be great.
Absolutely. I've been timing the testimonies thus far, and I'll make sure to stay underneath that.
Thank you very much.
The senator asked if arrests and handcuffs might be involved if the executive or legislative branches were to deliberately flout a direct court order. Not only would it be an appalling display of disrespect for the rule of law in our democracy if a court order were to be defied by another branch, but it would also be unwise in opening the door to actual physical conflict as citizens seek to take corrective action. Yes, Senator, I am sure there would be handcuffs and arrests, though probably not for those who would really deserve such. As citizens come to Juneau with handcuffs and attempt to place anyone necessary under citizens' arrest, the judicial branch may not have troopers for enforcement, but I myself and many others, I'm sure, would be entirely willing to go to jail if necessary in attempting to place whomever necessary in the administration or legislature under citizens' arrest if a court order is defied. I'll now begin testimony on behalf of my children, partner, and myself. This is sheer wedge issue politics, targeting a small group, a group which does much good and no harm in Alaska. Just as women should receive pay equal with that of men for performing equal work, we Alaskans, in long-standing committed relationships, raising children and contributing with our labor, all while being barred from marriage, absolutely have paid in equally and fully earned treatment equal with that accorded our married co-workers. This bigoted effort hurts Alaska's families and kids. Like a parasite, it brings more grief, expense, and suffering the bigger it is allowed to grow. In seeking to perform an end run on the justice of Alaska's courts in order to subvert the ruling for equal treatment under the law, some members of this legislature are attempting to turn married Alaskan co-workers into parasites. Yes, parasites. Parasites benefiting at the expense of others by unfairly leeching off the labor of co-workers with families. Respectable people and good neighbors, good Christians, do not embrace being like tapeworms. pandering to prejudice. Some members of this legislature are trying to target same-sex families and their children for special discriminatory exclusion. Instead of protecting equality and citizens' rights, this effort would strip away equal treatment and unjustly target a specific group, unmarried families, for harm while creating special privileges for others, married families, thus effectively forcing married coworkers and their families to become parasites upon unmarried coworkers with families in committed same-sex relationships. Only hypocrites who give lip service to ideals of small government and equality under the law, while intruding their own personal and religious prejudices into their neighbors' lives, would support this ugly effort. Hypocrites and parasites do not make for good coworkers, nor good neighbors, nor a healthy Alaska. Such parasites are without any shred of fairness, honor, or dignity. Legislators and others who embrace being parasites should not even think about trying to claim the high moral ground on this issue. Alaska's courts have ruled, and the Commissioner of Administration is able to implement the ruling. For shame, people. Please stop this heinous pandering now, and let us all just live in peace. Thank you. Are there any questions?
I don't see any hands raised. I appreciate your calling in, though. Thank you. Barbara Belknap.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Belknap. I am the president of the Juneau chapter of the National Organization for Women, an organization that has been fighting for equality for 40 years. I would like to say that two people who gave previous testimony talking about the will of the people do not speak for many Alaskans, including all the people who testified overwhelmingly in favor of same-sex benefits during the last session. I am here to testify against CCSB 4001 and to let the Alaska Supreme and to urge the legislature to let the Alaska Supreme Court ruling and the recommendations of the Superior Court stand. Real people are being impacted by the roadblocks put up by the legislative and the administrative branches. Yesterday, the government of South Africa announced that it is legalizing same-sex marriages and same-sex civil unions. Their reasoning is that they have attacked discrimination based on race and could not ignore discrimination based on sexual preference. While state legislatures across the country have passed laws or constitutional amendments stating that marriage is between a man and a woman, hundreds of city governments, 11 state governments, and more than half of the United States' largest corporations offer benefit plans to same-sex couples. They are eradicating one of the last bastions of overt discrimination in the workplace. Martin Luther King said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." We have a state constitution that clearly affords justice towards all. It is simply and unequivocally stated in the Alaska Constitution in Article 1, Section 1 on inherent rights, where it says, quote, "All persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protection under the law." The judicial branch is not legislating from the bench. It is doing its job in enforcing the Constitution of the state of Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Barbara. Any questions for Ms. Belknap? Thank you. It's always good to see you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Asher Buck? Oh, I'd also like to recognize that Senator Wagoner has joined us. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Marcia Buck, and I'm here representing PFLAG Juneau. PFLAG stands for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. I am the mother of an adult daughter who grew up in Eagle River and graduated from Chugiak High. I'm here to ask you to vote no on the committee substitute for 4001 and to not pass it out of committee. I would like to testify just briefly on why I feel that you should be opposed to the committee substitute on financial and human grounds, but mostly on human grounds, that's what I know best. What makes financial sense to me is to implement same-sex partner benefits and to do so by January 1. I think it's time to stop resisting and do what's right by Alaska citizens and by the Alaska Constitution. It's less of a financial obligation on the part of the state to provide benefits than to be left with the costs for those who are not covered by insurance benefits and must of necessity turn to the state for service. Personally, I know of several families here in Juneau who, if they do not get benefits by January 1, are going to be in a world of hurt and are going to need some help. The January 1 date turns out to be one that people have planned for, and it is needed by families, and personally several who are going to be hurt here in Juneau. And then I would ask, from some of the discussion earlier, isn't it costly to be found in contempt of court? It seems like that might be a financial obligation. And on the human side, why I would like you to vote no is that my daughter and many other families like hers will be deeply hurt if constitutionally given rights are delayed beyond January 1st or, heaven forbid, be denied later or inequitably provided. I've been wondering a lot lately on why it is no longer acceptable to talk about delaying benefits to things like Alaska Native children and families or African American children and families. That's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to talk about delaying benefits for families with disabilities. And then I wonder, why is it acceptable for us to be talking about delaying or not providing benefits to my daughter and her family and children? Why? What is it about our culture that's made it now acceptable to talk about not providing benefits to children and families of same-sex couples? And to me, that means my grandchildren. I mean, what is it in our minds of us or you who are elected to be supporters of the underserved Alaskan children and families and supporters of family values? What makes it acceptable to even be discussing delaying or not providing benefits? So I would ask you to please vote no on Committee Substitute 4001 and provide equitable benefits by January 1. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Lynn Davis?
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. I, like the two speakers before me, would ask you to vote against 4001 and any of the changes and to implement benefits by January 1. I am a plaintiff in this case, and we began our preparations for it back in 1998 after the constitutional amendment. I've been in a long-term relationship, and love and commitment and family mean the same to me as they do to you. And I'm 9 years older than my partner, and I wanted to be able for her to be protected and have the same kind of financial safety net that my other coworkers have. So in 1999, our suit went forward. At that point, I had just been with the state for 3 years. I was kind of a newbie. And here I am today, 10 years I've been with the state, and I am not getting equal pay for equal work. And we have a fairly compelling situation in my family. My partner of 18 and a half years was laid off from her 13-year job in the summer of 2005. In March of 07, her 18-month COBRA runs out. And I don't know if any of you have had experience with these COBRAs. They are very expensive, and she has started a small business, and it's hard to grow that business and also be able to pay for health care, her own coverage, as a 55-year-old. So we are really counting on the January 1 implementation. I'm just really disappointed in this state. I feel like I work out at the Juneau Job Center. I work with people who are unemployed, and I've been really dedicated to that work. And I don't feel like I'm receiving back from the state the same kind of stewardship and dedication that I am given. And I want to end. I have a show and tell. My dad, who would actually have been very comfortable with all of you who are not comfortable with giving us benefits, worked for GE most of his life. And when he died, I received his GE stock. And here is my 2005 annual report from GE with the word big on it. And on page 11, they talk about five of their big business success traits. And one of them is to include, to be inclusive and give partner benefits for same-sex couples. And we know that GE is one of our big PFD companies that we rely on. And they have certainly demonstrated that boldly giving domestic partner benefits to same-sex couples works. It's good for the bottom line. It's good for everybody. It's good for the order. And, you know, I would ask that the state of Alaska and whatever it is that you need to do to boldly go forward with our benefits. It's humane. It's right. And we'll join the other states that have been giving benefits to same-sex domestic partners, and it's been working well for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn, for being here. I think Cindy Besser for Ben Crawl. I hope I pronounced those names correctly.
That's right. Thank you. Hi. I think first I'm going to meet my son, Ben, because I need to get back home to him pretty soon. Okay. My name is Cindy Besser, and I'm going to read the testimony that my son Ben Crawl wrote. He also testified last spring for the SJR 242, and some of you probably remember him from then. I am Ben Crawl. I am 11 years old and was born and raised in Juneau. I would like to testify against giving you any more time to do what you need to do. You just need to give the benefits to all the people of Alaska who deserve them for the work they do. It does not matter whether you like them or not. It doesn't matter whether you think they are okay. It doesn't even matter if you think you can afford it or not. That's not the point. It's just about it being what you owe them for the work they do. I just finished my first big paying job last week, walking my neighbor's dog for a month, and she paid me what it was worth. She wouldn't have cared if I liked girls or boys, because I don't really care about either, and because that really had nothing to do with the work or my pay. She didn't talk about whether she had enough money to do it or not either. That would be crazy. She had asked me to do the work and I had done the job. I have good friends who are lesbians and gays. One lesbian couple has two sweet babies. I've helped babysit some this summer. They're really responsible parents and take good care of those girls. And they both are hard workers too, but only one works for the state. They deserve to have full benefits for their work. Their kids need benefits too, and the couple needs to be able to take care of each other too. My dad works for the state of Alaska and gets benefits, but my mom doesn't work enough hours with the city to get benefits. Mom had her thyroid taken out last month, so I've been hearing them talk about expensive doctors and about insurance. What if they were a lesbian couple? Then she wouldn't have been able to use dad's insurance, and we'd owe like $15,000. We don't have that much, and I bet lots of gay lesbians probably don't either. I'm really disgusted with the governor for wasting all that money on flying you all down here, because he and his prejudiced gang think they know better than the Supreme Court. They decided these people deserve the benefits because our Constitution says so. That's good enough for me, and I bet it's good enough for most people, unless they let their prejudice get in the way. All that needs to be done is just give the workers their benefits. It's a no-brainer. Ben Croft.
Thank you. Do we have a copy of that?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I made it to the Health Social Service because that's who we thought he was going to be testifying for. But
okay, that's
and he would have been here, but we looked at it online last night and it was still to be announced, and so he made other plans.
Okay, that's great. Okay,
and for my testimony, because I signed up after him, so I get okay. More time, right? let's see, first a real quick response to the Anchorage people. About the will of the people, I've lived in the South too. I was raised here in Juneau, been here since 59. And I went to school down the South, and I believe there's some places down there where if you did the will of the people or the majority of the people, you still wouldn't have benefits for black people. I mean, it's it's, if you go by the will of people, you may not get what meets the Constitution. And there are times, especially where prejudice is involved, that courts need to remind us that we live in a constitutional society. Since this is the Finance Committee, I've been thinking about when I was a former employer in Juneau. Years ago, I took over a directorship of a large child care center, which had had about an 80% turnover for several years. I had a wonderful administrative assistant that helped the place run, and then one day she gave notice, and guess why? Because we didn't have benefits. Wages weren't great either, but mostly she needed benefits. So she took a job with the state. I went to the parents. I went to see if there was a majority and asked if they could afford. First I asked, can you afford the rate of this child care? And most people said no, and there's all complaining and moaning rose up. And then I asked them a different question. I said, how many of you would work your job if they cut your benefits, if you didn't have benefits? And nobody raised their hand. I said, well, I can't run this place unless I can offer these people benefits, because it's just not right. You know, and you can't afford, what you can't afford is to have your kids raised by the people, kind of people I can hire who will work without benefits. And that's a no-brainer, too. To make a long story short, I offered the benefits the next month, and I had no turnover except for people leaving town for the duration of my years there. We always met our budget somehow, and we met it ethically by providing our employees with benefits. The city, and you may notice, of Juneau has employee benefits, and it hasn't exactly broken their back, and they're not a rich city either. As my son says, this is not about whether you can afford it. It's not about marriage, and it's not about sexuality. It's about equal compensation for equal work. And unfortunately, it's about discrimination that needs to be stopped now. Last night, we were sledding, and when my son hit his head on a bump, I discovered my son has learned some new words in school. Or somewhere. If you put off giving these benefits as soon as possible, as you should, I'm afraid I'll have to do some serious editing to the next commentary he gives to this system. I really can't say it much better than my son. It's a no-brainer, and putting it off is simply politics. My son believes in our political system. He volunteered for Kids Vote this month. Please don't disgust him any further. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Is there anyone else in the room who's not signed up and wishes to testify? Or online? Thank you very much. That concludes public testimony. Senator Dyson, I see the amendment you brought forward, but if I could ask you if we could hold off on this till next we meet and maybe give us a chance to mull this over and kind of see where we're headed. Did you want to speak to it?
Certainly, Madam Chair, and this is not my work. It's from Ledge Legal at my request, and I don't know whether it works or not. And the only need, that's fine.
Thank you very much. Okay, that's fine. We have one more person that's just called in to testify. Oh, and who's online?
This is Debbie Jocelyn.
Oh, hi, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Debbie Jocelyn from Delta Junction. I'm president of Eagle Form Alaska, and I'm calling in to ask you to pass the committee substitute. I don't hate anyone. I don't have any ill will toward anyone, but I do see very clearly, as does everyone else, that the court is legislating from the bench. And I'm urging you to not give benefits to same-sex couples. This is a backdoor attempt to achieve the same status as married couples in our state. Marriage should be a preferred and protected status, and to do anything different, to elevate same-sex couples' relationships the same as marriage in this manner, is just taking us further down the road to destruction of our society and our social fabric, and I urge you not to be part of that.
Thank you for your testimony, Debbie. Appreciate your calling in. Is there anyone else? Are there any questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much. We are going to set this aside for now, and I'm going to recess. I doubt that we'll be coming back today, but in case we find some reason we need to come back, we'll have the option of coming back in later this afternoon.
And I know we have members who are going to be departing and different things, but if it's necessary, we can come back in and finish our work. Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair. Would it be possible then that we could get some updated legal work on the impact of these amendments and stuff? The one we have here is rather alarming with multiple paragraphs of issues. Maybe we can get more work done on this particular issue before we come to the table, and unless this amendment is going to iron out a lot of these, and I don't know if it is or not. Looks like it might take care of some of them.
Okay, you want further clarification on the Ledge Legal memo?
The memo from Legislative Council, from Ledge Services.
Ledge Legal, okay.
It just might speed things up if some of this stuff is worked out a little bit before.
Do you have any specific questions? Are you just saying, number one, we cleared up anything by this amendment?
Right.
Is that your question? Okay. Number two, number three. Okay. Senator Wilkin, did you have your hand up?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, I'm ready to vote on the unamended committee substitute, and I would like to pass that out of committee at the earliest possible time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other comments? Okay. We will recess for now. And I thank everyone to testify. I appreciate your being here. We are at recess. Senate Finance will come back to order. We're coming back to order just for the purpose of adjourning this meeting for today, and message will be posted about Sunday, having a meeting sometime Sunday afternoon. And so follow that announcement, and we'll be back here on Sunday afternoon. We are adjourned. I'll be right back.